In this weekend's episode, three segments from this past week's Washington Journal. First, the Supreme Court is set to decide a number of high-profile cases related to the 2024 presidential election. Kimberly Whaley, law professor, writer, and legal contributor for ABC News, discusses the key legal and constitutional questions. Then, the number of homeless persons in the U.S. hit a record high in 2023. We'll speak with Steve Berg from the National Alliance to End Homelessness about what's driving this trend and how to address it. Plus, this week marked the fifth anniversary of the First Step Act, bipartisan criminal justice reform legislation signed by then-President Trump. We discussed the law's impact with criminal justice advocate Kevin Ring and Colleen Aaron, author of the new book Reform Nation, The First Step Act and the Movement to End Mass Incarceration.
People often think C-SPAN is funded by the federal government. In fact, we're a nonprofit organization that receives no government funding. As news consumption changes, you can help ensure the future of C-SPAN's unfiltered coverage of national government and politics. We hope you will consider making a tax-deductible contribution that will support our daily editorial operations. To learn more, visit c-span.org/donate.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's Ollie.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
First, constitutional law professor Kim Whaley discusses the key legal and constitutional questions before the Supreme Court relating to former President Trump.
Let's talk about some of the cases in front of the Supreme Court. I'm going to put them on the screen and then we'll go through each one in turn. So here's what's in front of the court now. It's the Colorado Supreme Court 14th Amendment ruling. Then there's the Trump immunity claim and then the challenge to obstruction law used to prosecute January 6 defendants. That's from The Washington Post and Politico. So, Kim, let's start with the first one, which is that Colorado Supreme Court ruling. Where does that stand as far as the Supreme Court?
Well, it looks like there's been talk from Trump's lawyers that they're interested in appealing it, and I think if they haven't already, they will. So there's a decision out of the Supreme Court of the state of Colorado. So every state has their own judicial system. It goes all the way up to a Supreme Court for the state. And the U.S. Supreme Court, the federal Supreme Court, can take certain cases from states if they want. So the question then would be, will the U.S. Supreme Court say, yes, we will review the decision of the Supreme Court of Colorado because it involves questions of federal law, that is, how to read the 14th Amendment, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution. The Colorado Supreme Court has said, listen, we'll hold off on enforcing or saying this ruling controls the primary in Colorado until we see what happens in this appeal. So right now, there's no actual effect from the ruling because they sort of put it on hold pending what the United States Supreme Court decides. But the primary is, you know, coming up. So the timing is very squished.
So if nothing happens, he's still going to be on the ballot?
Is if that nothing happens, he's still going to be on that unless they decide, oh, we're going to enforce it. So if the Supreme Court of the United States doesn't take the appeal, then he will not be on the ballot. So right now they're sort of saying, listen, we'll wait to see if the top Supreme Court in the United States steps in. If they don't, then he's not on the primary ballot come March for the primaries in Colorado.
And what's your opinion on that decision by the Colorado Supreme Court?
So this is very controversial, understandably, and I think it's very important to distinguish between political arguments and sort of normative arguments. That is what should happen, what's good for the country, what's good for the future of the process of elections and the law, right? I think on the law, on the Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, the Colorado Supreme Court majority is very, very strong and could be correct. That doesn't mean sort of it's a good idea, but the job of judges is to apply the law, not to sort of make decisions about the sort of political implications of something.
And I'll just put a piece of that Supreme Court ruling up on the screen. It says President Trump did not merely incite the insurrection. Even when the siege on the Capitol was fully underway, he continued to support it by repeatedly demanding that Vice President Mike Pence refuse to perform his constitutional duty and by calling senators to persuade them to stop the counting of electoral votes. It continues. But I want to ask you about the dissent on that. And one of the dissenters was Colorado Supreme Court Justice Carlos Samore. And he talked about the issue of due process. Talk about that.
Okay, so just to, people understand, after the Civil War, when there was reconstruction of the country, the North and the South came back together, three amendments, 13th, 14th, 15th. In the 14th includes a provision that says if you were an officer, you took an oath for the Confederacy, the South, and you engaged in insurrection, that is the Civil War, you cannot hold office again. That's the process. That's the provision that's at stake here. A number of questions. What's an insurrection? What's engage? Is the President of the United States an officer? Those are the questions. The dissenting justice said, well, you need to have effectively, he said a number of things, but you need to have a full-blown criminal trial that Donald Trump would be charged with insurrection and that there would effectively be a jury verdict beyond a reasonable doubt under the criminal system to actually find that he engaged in an insurrection. What happened in Colorado was a civil decision by a judge after a trial. There was a five-day evidentiary trial. There were witnesses, there were documents. Donald Trump's lawyers had the ability to put on a defense. And so the dissenting justice talking about due process, but due process doesn't always mean a full-blown criminal trial. Due process, I think the argument for the majority would be, was the evidentiary hearing that he did get, right? So everything doesn't have to go through that very high bar of a criminal process. But that's a question that's not really addressed one way or the other in the actual 14th Amendment.
So what impact is there a potential now for other states to follow suit on Colorado's decision, or are they going to wait and see what the Supreme Court decides to do?
So this has actually been percolating in many places in the country. I think there's over a dozen other states that have similar claims in the court system. There are multiple states where the claims have failed for a number of reasons. Either the wrong plaintiff brought it or the state law didn't authorize this kind of thing. I think it's really important to keep in mind there is no national federal way to walk into court and say, keep any candidate off the ballot across the country. Every state has to apply their own state law. So the Colorado Supreme Court decision was really about Colorado's rules for getting on the ballot. And so could it affect other judges? They could read the Colorado decision and say, we think this makes a lot of sense. It's between all four opinions. There were three separate dissents. I think it was 213 pages. It's a very thorough scholarly analysis, but it wouldn't control anyone else unless the Supreme Court takes the case and decides it in a way that would affect the entire country. The court could decide it on a really narrow ground that actually doesn't impact anyone outside the state of Colorado.
And the Newsweek actually has an article about Neil Gorsuch saying that Neil Gorsuch could strike the death knell for Donald Trump. Apparently he made a decision that has some bearing on this case.
Yeah, so I think it's probably fair to anticipate that Justices Thomas and Justice Alito would be uncomfortable with this decision. Maybe Justice Kagan, Justice Sotomayor, Justice Jackson might be agree with the majority, in part because it's a very conservative, originalist writing. They use the plain language. They go back to the dictionaries from the time of the ratification of the Constitution. They look at this. They kind of say, listen, states get to do what states should be able to do. Very conservative approach to finding that Donald Trump is disqualified. And so I think the question is Gorsuch, you know, they're pulling out of a different case. It's not exactly the same. Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, Chief Justice Roberts, I think, you know, and Justice Coney Barrett, where would they fall in that, in kind of that makeup? And you'd need five votes if this were actually to get to the merits, that is the full-blown consideration by the court. And I think those are the justices that are in the mix.
And three of them were put there by Donald Trump,
right,
which is a little strange. And then you've got Justice Clarence Thomas, whose wife was involved, somewhat involved. What do you think of that?
Yeah, so some would say that Justice Thomas, at a minimum, should recuse himself. So there were many multiple cases. I don't know how many. There's a handful of cases after the November 2020 election involving Donald Trump's claim of fraud, involving how the ballot should be counted because of COVID. And Justice Thomas didn't recuse himself and didn't make it even known that his wife was involved in efforts to not to persuade Vice President Pence to not certify the election for Joe Biden. But there is no, the Supreme Court has a new code of ethics, but there's no enforcement mechanism. So it's really up to the justices to recuse themselves or not. No, there's no police on the beat to say, if you don't do it, you're in trouble. There's no accountability. So I think that's probably unlikely. And the suggestion that just because a president appointed you, you should recuse, I mean, you know, that would be a problem for the Supreme Court anytime a president appoint someone and they're still president, because all kinds of cases involving the federal government, you know, and the presidency and the executive branch come up before the court. So I don't think that's a really strong argument for recusal. That is Kavanaugh and Coney Barrett.
Let's go to the next case, which is the Trump immunity claim. Explain mm-hmm. it.
This I think is probably easier than the Section 3 14th Amendment claim. So there's nothing in the Constitution that says presidents have immunity from anything. It's implied. But the idea is, listen, if the president's doing presidential things, making decisions about, you know, how to run the executive branch or making decisions around how to manage the military, they can't be sued, right? It can't be sued for doing presidential things, because then they'll just stop, you know, making good decisions. They'll worry about their own liability. That's the question of immunity. Donald Trump has said, effectively, everything I did relating to January 6th was part of my presidential duties. And so there should be all of the indictments, essentially. Well, this was in just the January 6th case brought by Jack Smith. They should all get thrown out because I was being president. The problem with that, of course, is presidents aren't kings. There are absolutely limits on that. And there was this two decisions out of the D.C. courts, two different cases, one from the higher court, one from the trial court, that essentially said, you know, this D.C. Circuit said, listen, when he was trying to get reelected, that was him acting as a candidate. That was not him acting as president. And also, you know, the idea that presidents who have the power over the military, who have a power over the FBI, the CIA, surveillance power, can commit crimes in office, allegedly, and then have no accountability, that makes absolutely no sense. So I think that's not going to win the day in the Supreme Court, but it could delay the January 6th trial, which is now scheduled for March 4th. And if that gets delayed long enough past the election and Donald Trump is reelected, he could just tell the Justice Department to kill the case, or he could pardon himself.
That was Kim Whaley, law professor, writer, and legal contributor for ABC News.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Next, we speak with Steve Berg from the National Alliance to End Homelessness about a new government report showing the number of homeless persons in the U.S. reaching a record high this past year.
This is the Wall Street Journal with this headline, U.S. homeless count surges 12% to highest recorded level. First, why did it go up so high?
Well, there's sort of short-term things and long-term things. The short-term things, I think there were aid programs during COVID that ended, and so they were helping. There were, the states had money from the federal government to help people pay rent. Those programs ended. We're seeing a lot of people first-time homeless. But then the longer-term trend is just the long-term trend in housing, rental housing, getting more expensive. The trend of modest rents for a modest apartment going up faster than wages in a modest job is something that's been going on for decades, and it's really starting to overwhelm people.
And how is this count done? I mean, how do you really count homelessness?
Yeah, these annual counts are done in each community, gets organized. They get a lot of volunteers to come out and go out over the course of a couple of nights in January and find people who are living on the streets and just get a little basic information from them and just get a good count. And then people who are staying in shelters or other kind of temporary housing are always counted, but that's a little easier because the people running the shelters know how many people are there.
And the rate of families that are experiencing homelessness, families with children, mm-hmm. that rate has also gone up.
Yes, not as fast. And that was particularly a sort of a good news story from the COVID era, that because of some of these assistance programs, particularly targeted to families with kids, there were a lot fewer families falling into homelessness because of those assistance programs. But then those have ended, and now we're seeing an increase there as well.
What do you say to people that say, look, you know, homelessness has gone up, it continues to go up, all these federal programs and all this money that's going into it is just not working?
Yeah, unfortunately, the federal programs are not really funded at anywhere near the level they need to be to actually solve the problem. I mean, it's interesting to compare, like, federal housing programs with, like, healthcare programs, for example. The healthcare programs are really sort of entitlement funding. Like, everyone who's eligible for, say, the Medicaid program gets help. And so for, say, people in nursing homes, the Medicaid pays for 40% of Americans who are in nursing homes. And anyone who's eligible gets the help. Whereas the housing programs, there are federal housing programs, but they're funded, like, to serve about a quarter of the people who are eligible, and the other three quarters just go on a waiting list and wait sometimes for years to get any help. So this is the federal funding in the housing area is really falling short, I'm afraid.
So what does the federal government need to do besides more funding?
Yeah, so the more funding is important. As I said, you know, homelessness is essentially a housing problem. And the housing is expensive, and it's getting more expensive, and the federal programs just aren't keeping up at all. The federal government funds homeless programs in every community that help find people who are homeless, helps keep them safe, provide shelters, short-term temporary housing for people, and then helps them sort of wade through whatever bureaucracy they have to wade through in order to try to get housed. Those programs are important, again, not funded at the level that they need to be to really serve everybody. And then I think the other thing that's important is healthcare. I mean, there's a lot of healthcare issues among the homeless population, whether behavioral health care, substance abuse, mental health problems, but also just a lot of physical health problems. People being, you know, are released from the hospital. If they don't have a place to live, they just go right to the street. So you see people living on the street with serious medical conditions.
And also, in addition to medical, how big of a problem is mental health issues among the homeless population?
So I think the estimate that data shows is like maybe a quarter of people who are homeless have some sort of mental health problem, a lot of times a serious mental health problem. So this is, you know, it's not like everybody who's homeless is mentally ill, or even most people, but it is, you know, 25% is more than in the general population. So the homeless programs, that ends up being communities' responses to mental illness a lot of times, because a lot of people have trouble getting treatment. The treatment is either not available, or it's underfunded, or it's there's bureaucratic rules to try to get into the treatment. So a lot of people just end up on the streets with a mental health problem.
And there's, you know, there's people that are like first time homeless or temporarily homeless, and then there's the chronic homeless.
Right.
First, how do you define chronic homelessness, and what's the difference in the policies that would alleviate the kind of the first timers and the chronic?
Yeah, so chronic homelessness has a complicated definition in federal law, but it's basically people who are homeless a long time and tend to be people with disabilities, with health issues, behavioral health issues, which is why they stay homeless for a long time, because it's hard to find a landlord who will rent to people. There are sort of program models, if you will, that the people who run these homeless programs have figured out over the years are particularly effective for people with who have been homeless for a long time and have a disability, maybe a mental disability. The intervention, they use the name permanent supportive housing. So it's a long-term rent subsidy, because people won't be able to work, so they won't be able to pay rent themselves. So they get help paying the rent, and they also get a menu of supportive services. It includes mental health treatment and other kinds of things people need in order to stay stable in their houses. Now, other people don't have those more severe problems. As you said, they might have just fallen into homelessness recently because of a string of bad luck. For people like that, we usually find that a much shorter term intervention works really well. People get help finding a landlord who will rent to them, maybe a couple of months of rent, a security deposit, and then people to come and help them deal with whatever they're dealing with, usually getting a job. The VA, the Department of Veterans Affairs, runs a really good program that gets great results for veterans in that kind of situation. So that's one of the models.
And I wanted to ask you about that, and we will start taking calls shortly, but the veteran homelessness among veterans had been going down, but then it went back up. Why?
Yeah, it's the same. Excuse me. It's the same reasons. It's people are dealing with increased housing costs, the cost of housing going up faster than wages, and then these other kinds of, you know, COVID era sorts of issues, and so we just see a lot of people falling into homelessness for the first time.
That was Steve Berg, Chief Policy Officer for the National Alliance to End Homelessness. Next, a conversation about the First Step Act, bipartisan criminal justice reform legislation signed into law 5 years ago this week. Criminal justice advocate Kevin Ring and Colleen Aaron, author of the new book, Reform Nation, discussed the law's impact so far.
Let's go back 5 years, because that's when the First Step Act was signed into legislation by then President Trump. Set the stage for us. What were the problems in the criminal justice system that act was trying to solve?
Well, the First Step Act was a modest criminal justice reform bill. By any stretch of the imagination, it was focused on the federal system. But what made it so significant was that it was one of the only federal criminal bills over the past 50 years that was focused on ameliorating conditions in prison and decarceration. So I think that we had arrived at this period in 2018 where we recognized that we had over-incarcerated and there was a widespread consensus that we had gone too far with our incarceration rates. And so the First Step Act was a first step towards reversing those types of trends.
And Kevin, you're a criminal justice advocate. Tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to this topic.
Well, it's a pretty unusual route. I came to Washington to work on Capitol Hill as a staffer, and I was a sort of conventional Republican, tough on crime staffer, and I knew the talking points of what we believed in because my upbringing had been one that was pretty much removed from criminal activity. And I worked on Capitol Hill. I wrote some anti-crime legislation. After a while, I went to law school. I became a lobbyist, and then I got embroiled in a enormous lobbying scandal, which was led by Jack Abramoff, who many people probably remember. And our whole firm came under investigation. I cooperated with the government. Ultimately, they decided to charge me. I went through two trials. The first time the jury hung, and the second time I was convicted of half the accounts of public corruption charges. And so I ended up going to prison myself. And not only did I go to prison for 20 months, but I ended up serving time with people whose sentences were a little longer because of bills I had written while I was on Capitol Hill. And during that time where I was fighting the government, I was working for an organization called FAM, which is a sentencing reform organization. And I was as heartsick as I was about my situation and how it might impact my family, I was starting to have my eyes opened about how it was hurting others in much greater ways. And so by the time I got to prison, I knew we needed to make change. And when I came home, I went right into advocacy, and I've been doing that ever since.
And Kevin, you wrote an op-ed for The Hill. It says, the First Step Act wasn't a mistake, but criminal justice reformers dropped the ball. Can you tell us about why you wrote that op-ed and what your major points were?
Yeah, I think a little bit goes to your first question to Colleen, which was, how are we talking about criminal justice reform at this time when crime has been increased? And I think it's the time we should absolutely be talking about it, because I think criminal justice reform is the answer, not the problem. A system that locks up, you know, is turning our prisons into nursing homes, that only solves 50% of murders and fewer rapes. The fact that a system that does not take those crimes seriously enough to solve those, but instead locks, you know, low-level drug offenders up for life sentences, is completely out of whack. And so people.
But can't you do both? Can't you solve the crimes and be tough on crime so that people are deterred from those crimes?
Yeah, but everything we know from the research is that people are not deterred by the severity of a sentence. What they're deterred by is whether they think they're going to get caught and are they going to be held accountable. But you don't need to hold somebody 20 or 25 years to deter, especially a young person, from committing a crime. That is one of the most clearest findings from the evidence that we have. And so, yeah, we are all for accountability. And what's happening right now in Washington, D.C., for instance, bothers everyone who is concerned about public safety. We all are. But we've just got to be smarter. And, you know, Thomas Sowell said, there's no solutions, only trade-offs. And our budgets are finite. And so we're spending $80 billion on public safety. And our question always is, are we getting the most safety for that amount? And in our view, we could do better. And so with this rise in crime, I think the answer has been not to defend a system that is not solving serious violent crimes that people are concerned about, and not defending that, instead saying we would need more reform. We need to, you know, change up how we use our resources to make sure that we are keeping people safe.
And it's been in place for 5 years. Mm-hmm. How has it worked? What results have we seen?
I think that the results have been very promising. Families Against Mandatory Minimums has been releasing some of the statistics. So 30,000 people have been released as a result of the First Step Act. But in terms of public safety, which is, of course, a paramount concern, only 12.3% of those who were released by the First Step Act were returned versus 42% of those who were not released under the First Step Act. So it's showing very promising results. Also, those people who were sentenced under the unfair crack cocaine laws that were rectified in the Fair Sentencing Act, that was made retroactive. And so we have people coming home thanks to the First Step Act. Also, compassionate release for those who have compelling cases of sickness, illness. About 4,000 people have have been released as a result of the expansion of compassionate release there. And that's effective, it's efficient, and it's completely in line with public safety, which was always really one of the paramount concerns of this bill. It was a very modest conservative bill that was focused on risk and likelihood of recidivating.
That was criminal justice advocate Kevin Ring and Colleen Aaron, author of the new book, Reform Nation, The First Step Act and the Movement to End Mass Incarceration. Hear more interviews from C-SPAN's Washington Journal program on our website at cspan.org, on the C-SPAN Now app, or on C-SPAN Television, live every morning from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern.